I am thrilled to be here with Alex O'Connor, who I've had my eye on for a long time because I think he's brilliant, and I think the work he's doing in trying to bring philosophical discussion to people on YouTube is just superlative. I've seen him in various conversations and various debates, and so I contacted him several months ago and said, hey, let's talk about morality at this conference, and he graciously said yes, and here we are. And this is a bit of a reprieve for you because you're not having to argue against a religious person who's advocating God, which is much of what you do. So
that's right. I'm looking forward to it. I hopefully will bring the same fervor and hopefully respectability too, but we'll see how we do.
All right, we'll see. Maybe it's either going to be respectable or it's going to turn into an atheist cage match.
That would be
one or the other. We'll see where it goes. Well, let's do this. The topic is morality, objective or subjective. And why don't you start? Why don't you just give a 5-ish minutes, whatever works, on what your basic view is and why you hold it to be subjective or whatever the technical terms are that you're going to employ.
Fine by me. The terms can be a bit confusing, I think, objective and subjective. I'm usually careful to clarify that I'm not really a moral subjectivist because subjectivism is a sort of theory of ethical truth that says things are true or false dependent on mental states. Things are true because you want them to be true or in some way dependent on your desires or values or something like this. I broadly subscribe to an ethical view called emotivism, which doesn't quite say this. What it says is that ethical statements are expressions of emotion. So when you make an ethical statement, when you say that murder is wrong, you're expressing a kind of emotion. This is a view that's been popularly held by a number of people. It was, in the 20th century, most closely associated with A.J. Ayer and his philosophy of logical positivism, which has largely gone out of favor for being self-defeating and not capturing a lot of what philosophy is about. But I think that the emotivist part can be salvaged and remains a powerful critique to moral objectivism. To be clear, if you were to say murder is wrong, I think the best way of getting at what your metaethics is to translate that into a different phrase that doesn't use the word wrong and see what you're actually trying to say. So murder is wrong, that might translate as something like, I don't like murder. That's not emotivism. That's moral subjectivism. Because to say I don't like murder is just to report a fact. It's just it's a true fact about my brain that I don't like murder. And so me saying murder is wrong, reporting that, would just be making a claim about my psychology. That's not what emotivism is. Emotivism says that when you say murder is wrong, you are expressing the dislike itself. So saying murder is wrong is not the same thing as saying I don't like murder. It's expressing the dislike. So A.J. Ayer famously had it as murder is wrong translates roughly to something like boo murder. You can think of it as the difference between saying murder and saying murder is wrong is like the difference between writing down murder and then writing down murder with an exclamation mark and an angry emoji. It adds something, it tells you something about the mental state of the person you're speaking to, but it doesn't add anything propositional. It doesn't change, it's not the kind of thing that can be true or false. This is the most radical thing about emotivism. It means that moral claims don't have truth value. They can't be true and false. The emotivist recognizes that if you pay attention to what's going on when you have a moral feeling, when you see a homeless person being kicked for no reason, what happens in your brain? Well, you've seen a set of objective facts. You can say, a person has been kicked. That's true. It doesn't do anything moral. You could say, I don't like that this person has been kicked. That's reporting a psychological fact. Again, nothing moral. You're just stating facts. But there's this added element, there's this added thing that you feel, and it's something like don't. It's something like stop. It's something like boo. All of these things are not things that can have truth value. They're emotions. One of the ways that I would describe this is to imagine that we didn't have a word for anxiety, the feeling of anxiety. Imagine there was just no such word for it, and you were feeling anxious, and you were trying to describe to somebody how you felt. And you would say, well, it's a bit like being sad, but it's kind of like being excited at the same time. It would be difficult to explain. You could offer these analogies, but it's its own unique feeling. And what we've done is we've sort of identified that feeling and given it a name, which is anxiety. Now, that thing that you feel, that thing that makes things you consider to be immoral different from other kinds of events, whatever that thing is, I think we've also identified that emotion, put a label on it, and that label is good or bad or right and wrong, virtuous, not virtuous, these kinds of terms. I think they apply to an emotion. So a confusion about emotivism is that good and bad sort of map on to other emotions. So when you say something is good, you mean to express pleasure or how impressed you are or something like that. These are all just analogies. It is its own unique, sui generis emotion. It just belongs in that category. So when A.S. says, boo, murder, he doesn't mean that's what murder is wrong means. It just means something a bit like that. That's the best way of translating it into other emotive language. But whatever this wrong thing is that you feel, it belongs in that category of emotion. That's my view of emotivism. And I'll pass it on to you, but I will say that the principal challenge that I have for an objectivist about ethics is to say, we observe this world. There's a bunch of people in the room right now. I can see and observe certain things. I can see a table and a chair. I can hear voices. I can experience the air. I can feel it on my face. I'm told that somewhere in this room, maybe it's in our brains, maybe it's in the air between us, you know, that there's this thing called ought, called should, called good, that somewhere exists, maybe immaterially. That's a problem if you're a materialist, if you only believe in material things, you don't really have that option available to you. It has to be somewhere in this room or somewhere in this earth. There's this thing in the universe called good and bad, and all I'm asking is, firstly, what is that thing, if not just an emotion? And secondly, where does it come from?
Thank you. That was very concise. All right, so I'm just going to give primarily a positive case for why I think morality is objective, and then I'll address a little bit of the challenge there at the end, which I think will kind of flow out of what I present. So either we need evaluative terms like good, bad, should, shouldn't, right, wrong, or we don't. It's either or. And if we don't need them, then we should stop using them because they don't serve any purpose. If we do need them, then the reason why we need them is going to shed a lot of light on what their reference are in reality. The reason why we need them, the facts that give rise to our need of them, are going to tie them to reality. Those are the facts to which they refer. So for instance, if I say that murder is wrong, I am using the term wrong there to refer to some fact in reality. What is that fact? And this is where Ayn Rand's, as many of you know, I'm an advocate of Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism, but this is where Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism comes in, and it comes in two ways. First of all, I'm going to discuss a little bit about how she anchored morality in reality by identifying the factual requirements of human life as the standard of moral value, and then I'm going to use what I term the Ayn Rand question, which you're going to hear me use repeatedly in this discussion, I think, and that is, what facts of reality give rise to the need of this term we are using? Either there are facts that support a term and make it necessary for us to communicate ideas, or there are no facts, in which case it's just an arbitrary term, we have no need for it. So why do we need evaluative terms? Why do we need the term value? What does it refer to? Well, Rand identifies the fact that a value, in the way that we use it, just in plain language, means something that you go after, something you act to gain or keep. You value money, you value an education, you value a relationship, an education, or if you're religious, you value God. So you go to church because you're after a relationship with God. So before we even have a standard of morality, value simply means objects that we go after, objects of action. And she says, well, why do things go after objects? Why does anything go after things like that? And she observes that only one kind of thing goes after objects, and that is living beings, right? And this is not just humans, but living beings in general, you know, antelopes, cats, birds, and humans, and also flowers and trees, right? And what do? They go after something. If it's a tree, it burrows its roots into the ground, it turns its leaves toward the sky. If it's an antelope, it, you know, goes after its food and it runs away from the lion and so forth. What's going on here? Only living things go after values. Non-living things don't, right? So value, Rand says, is not a primary. It presupposes an answer to the question of value to whom and for what. So this is this contrasts with like A.J. Ayer, more specifically actually with G.E. Moore, who would hold that good is a primary, it's undefinable primary. Rand says it's not an undefinable primary. Good to whom and for what? If something is good, it has to have a being to whom it is good. And then there's got to be a reason why it's good. And Rand says the same about values. So she says, only living things go after values. And then she says, well, the to whom is answered by the thing going after the value, right? A bird is going after a worm. The worm is a value to the bird. Why is it going after the bird? What difference does it make if the worm doesn't get the worm? And Rand keeps going, and she says, if we keep looking at reality, at all the living things that go after values, what we see is that the reason they go after values is in order to remain alive. And she arrives at this very fundamental conclusion. There's only one fundamental alternative in the universe, existence or non-existence, and it pertains only to living organisms. A living thing can go out of existence, or its life can go out of existence. When something dies, that's what happens. Its chemical elements remain, but its life is gone. And she identifies that this is the very foundation that gives rise to the possibility of and the need of values. A thing can't go after values unless it's alive, and if it is to remain alive, it must go after values. In identifying this fact, Rand has demonstrated that life is the root, the ultimate foundation of the concept of value and of all evaluative concepts. Why do we need the concept ought or should or shouldn't? What do they refer to? In Rand's view, and I agree with her, they refer to the actions, you ought to do this, refers to an action that you should take if you want to remain in existence. Now, obviously, human beings, well, this may not be obvious because I think Alex disagrees with me on this, but I hold, and Rand holds, that we do have free will, that free will is the capacity to activate your mind or not, to think or not to think. And we need to think in order to live, so we need guidance in how to use our faculty of thinking, our rational faculty, so that we can live. So once she has designed or derived this principle that the factual requirements of human life constitute the standard of moral value, now, life is the standard for any living thing, but for human beings, because we have free will, moral values are chosen values. If you choose to live, and this is the last thing I'll say on this point, and then I'll address some of your other concerns. If you choose to live, now we do have this choice, you can, as an adult at least, you can choose to go out of existence. You can choose, I don't want to do this anymore, I'm gonna die, or take my own life. But if you choose to live, then after that choice is made, at least in terms of logical hierarchy, after that choice is made, you need the things that will enable you to live. We call those values, and then we call the actions that you take to get values virtues. And this is the way that Rand then starts to build a life-based morality on this standard of value of life that I think she has actually derived inductively, albeit. So this is, you know, and I know that there's some controversy in that. But I think she generalizes correctly, and that the very reason that values can exist and that we need to pursue them is because we are alive. So this is the basic meta-ethics. Meta-ethics is a technical term, just meaning how do we know the meaning of the terms that we're using in ethics? And then normative ethics is what should we do and why? What are the principles? So they're two different sets, but those are just technical terms. But that's basically the beginning of the underpinning for that. Now, there's much more I could say, but I want to pause. As to your concern that there's got to be an ought in here somewhere, Rand makes a really interesting distinction that I think helps with this. The normal way that people have thought about objectivity versus subjectivity has been that subjective means you just made it up, it's just in here, it's just arbitrary. And objective means it's out there somewhere. You know, like Plato's form of the good, right? That would be out there, or God in the Christian view, it's out there, and so you get the commandments or you get a revelation. And Rand said this is a false alternative, and it's a really problematic way of thinking about what objective is. So she came up with a trichotomy, and she said there is the subjective, which is just sort of going by whims or whatever you feel like doing. There's the intrinsic, which is the term she uses for the idea that the good is out there, detached from human beings, detached from our cognitive needs and from our needs at all. And we are it just sort of imprints on us, and then we have to do it, God's commandments or something like that. And she says the proper way to use the concept of objective is that the objective is the connection between the mind in here and a fact out there. And in this case, what she's saying is we are recognizing the fact that it is only life that makes the concept of values possible or necessary. And then she makes this final point. To use evaluative terms detached from life is to commit a fallacy that she called the concept of the fallacy of the stolen concept. It is to tear evaluative terms away from the very base that gives them meaning and ties them to reality. So it's a conceptual fallacy as against a logical fallacy. It's an abuse of a concept. And I think this is really enlightening. It is for me. It's like, yeah, if life really is the base and the root of all of this, and you tear the concept of value or should away from it, and then use that with utter disregard to its roots, you have stolen that concept away from there. So anyway, this is just a primer on the reason I think it is. So the ought in this room is the recognition of the fact that given our nature, we have to act in certain ways in order to live, and if we don't act successfully in those ways, we can't live.
Sure. If that's the basis of ethics, there are lots of questions I want to ask about different things you said there, but I suppose a place to start, to sort of throw a dart, as it were, if ethics requires the prospect of living and dying, that is to say that were you not a living being who could choose certain courses of action which would cause you to die, ethics cannot exist, if I understand you correctly?
Yes, she actually said that explicitly, that ethics applies, well, values apply only to living things, and ethics apply only to volitional living things.
Then I'd like you to imagine for a second an immortality pill that is discovered, invented by scientists, and perhaps to avoid some kind of overpopulation crisis, everybody sterilized at the discovery of this miraculous wonder drug, and at least some people take it, and they'll now live forever. And forget for a moment the sort of physical restrictions on this, the heat death of the universe. There's probably some way to imagine avoiding this inevitability. These people live forever. They're not going to die. Perhaps they're transported to some afterlife where they get to live forever in the New Jerusalem. Does ethics cease to exist? Does it no longer matter how I treat my fellow creature because the prospect of life and death is no longer on the table? That seems highly implausible to me.
Yeah, so a couple things. First of all, believe it or not, Ayn Rand uses the very example you're bringing up in her essay, The Objectivist Ethics. She says, suppose there's an immortal robot.
But the robot makes it...
I guess it's not identical. So people still can die.
Yep. Okay. No, sorry. People can't die, but they're still people. This is the thing. Ayn Rand's robot is this sort of non-volitional sort of material thing that just sort of exists. And that thing doesn't have ethics. And I think that, you know, everybody would agree quite intuitively that if something is dead, this table, it can't have ethics. It, of course, doesn't follow that if something is not dead, it can. What I'm looking for is, well, I suppose evidence of that is actually a separate thing. I'm just granting for a moment that that's the case, that ethics does rely on life and the prospect of courses of action that will lead to your death, and saying, take Ayn Rand's immortal robot, but turn it into an immortal person who still has free will, even though you're right, I don't believe in it, but again, I'll just grant it for the sake of this, can still suffer, still cares, still has emotions, You know, if we were suddenly immortal and I were causing somebody that you cared about to suffer in front of me, mm-hmm. and you told me to stop, I'd say, well, your moral import is gone because none of us can die anymore. So the suffering that they're experiencing can't be called immoral.
Yeah.
It might emotively matter to you, but then, of course, if you wanted to start using that as any kind of moral prescription, you'd be jumping over to my side of the fence. So, you know, where does this ethical force that I think most people in this room probably intuitively would still feel in that immortal situation come from?
Yeah, good question. I anytime there is a constructed experiment like this that is outside the realm of possibility as we know it, right? So the ring of Gyges, sometimes people bring it up. What if you had the ring of Gyges? Wouldn't you go around and rape and kill people then? And I always say, well, look, what's the purpose of this mind experiment when we're trying to figure out ethics for where we are here in this world living the way that we are? So the first thing I would say to this request is that not a lot hangs on it, if anything hangs on it, because no matter how I answer it, we still are not immortal, and we have to figure out how to live as human beings. Ethics is a practical subject. It's something that we need because we have to make life and death decisions and decisions that are going to help us or harm us in life, how to set up relationships, businesses, societies, you know, and all of that. So when we go to a wonderland of sorts and say, well, suppose that's not the case, but this other thing is the case, what would you do then? We're now really not dealing with ethics anymore. We're simply dealing with a different situation. Now, that said, I'll answer the question this way. If human beings could both be immortal, there's no way they could die, and yet they still have feelings and desires and can experience pain and joy, I think that ethics would still exist. It would just exist in a very different way than it does now. The right and wrong would not be about keeping you alive. It would be about making life simply the very best it could be, which, by the way, ethics is about now, too, because living... The point of according to the objectivist ethics, the point of ethics is not just to keep you alive, it's to keep you alive and enable you to flourish, to live to the fullest extent that you can, given your potentials, to really enjoy this one and only life that you have.
What would be that standard of
if you were to take away the...
If you take away the death
If you take away the death
element, what
then I guess you would standard? Just you'd just be able to enjoy things forever and just never have that stop.
So it would become like a hedonistic theory of ethics? It would become about maximizing
pleasure? It would become about maximizing flourishing.
Okay.
So you would, instead of living just, you know, in a mundane way, you would want to live in the richest way possible. But I wouldn't call it hedonism because okay. I don't think that mere pleasure is what makes human life interesting.
Sure. Well, whatever we want to call it, it seems to me, therefore, that if you can have a concept of flourishing and value, and indeed ethics, even if it's ethics of a different kind, without life and death, then I suppose I would look with suspicion upon your earlier supposition.
Yeah,
that
life would no longer
requires.
Be. The, life couldn't be the standard. If you can't die, life can't be the standard of life. But that's why I opposed. That's why I opposed the.
Suppose, for example, and I understand. I mean, a lot of people have this reticence to engage in thought experiments, and I understand it because they seem sort of wishy-washy and a bit out there. But they're tools in the way that, like, you know, you might have a really, really long, convoluted mathematical syllogism, which seems to be super impractical and totally weird, but somehow whatever it juts out at the end gives you some kind of practical
wisdom.
Value. So, but if you prefer, if you want a more imaginable, conceivable example, then suppose instead of living forever, everybody is immortal up to a point, and everybody knows their death date. Like everybody on their 25th birthday. It gets killed, and they know there's no way to avoid it. For whatever reason, they know the time, the place, the date that they're going to die 100%, and they know they can't die before,
yeah.
And they know they're not going to live any longer. This doesn't require this sort of strange vision of immortality and sort of universal conquest and avoiding the heat death. It seems to me that as long as it is even possible to say that there is such a thing as value in ethics in either of those situations, we cannot say that in principle ethics is about life.
So this is where I absolutely disagree, because you are taking fanciful thought experiments that do not happen, and as far as we know, cannot happen. Mm-hmm. So you're treating a metaphysical impossibility as the environment within which we need to investigate ethics.
Well, suppose you would
say... Well, let me just finish this thought, though, because I really think that's the wrong way to go about it. So I want to give you a hypothetical.
Sure.
Suppose we lived in this world, and suppose human beings were mortal, and suppose that they could either live beautiful, happy lives if they acted in certain ways, or miserable lives if they acted in other ways, or simply die if they didn't succeed in achieving their values. And there was a moral code that said the right way to live is in a way that enables you to live a beautiful, flourishing life in harmony with other people, leaving each other free to do their own thing so we can trade with each other and all of that. So you were given that alternative, or any other alternative in this same world. You were given another alternative of, well, people should be forced to do things against their will, or people should suffer as much as possible, or anything like that. Which of those alternatives would you choose?
The first.
Yeah, see, if we're here in this world thinking about the real facts that are before us, and when we're, you know, there are a bunch of young people here from all over the world, and what they need to know is, how am I supposed to act in this life? They're not right. jonesing for... How am I supposed to act in those made-up worlds?
Yeah, I mean,
the made-up stuff is fun. Harry Potter is fun, but it's not the thing we need to focus
those
on.
Those made-up worlds are, of course, supposed to be used as a tool to investigate the definition of terms.
Yeah. But
so it's sort of like imagining if you were to say that your shirt was part of your body, an intrinsic part of your body, and I said, well, can you imagine a situation in which you didn't have your shirt on? And you say, yes. Even though that world doesn't exist, it helps us to make a point in the real world that your shirt is not identical with your body. And similarly, if you say that ethics is identical to, well, I shouldn't say identical, but is intrinsically reliant upon the concept of death, then we construct another imaginary world where we separate them out. And we say that, well, here's a world in which ethics exists, but death does not. I think that shows that in principle it can't be about life and death. But also, I mean, you asked me which of those worlds I'd prefer. But that's just it. It's a preference. I mean, if I could live my life in fear every day for the rest of my life, or live my life in pleasure for the rest of my life, I'd pick the latter, not because I think there's some objective rule of the universe that somehow gives me a prescription to do so, but just because I prefer it, because it's an emotionally preferable state for me. And that's how I approach that kind of dichotomy as well. That's why I would prefer to live in that world.
Yeah.
And I suppose what I'd want to ask you in return as well is that There are so many things. I mean, for example, I want to know how your egoistic ethic, your rational egoism that you derive from objectivism and Ayn Rand, that the rational thing to do, and indeed the ethical thing to do, therefore the thing you're mandated to do, is whatever's going to help your survival as a creature. I want to know where something intuitively unethical like torturing an animal comes into this. Because when I say, well, why should I care about somebody else? It's very easy to say, well, my survival prospects are actually much increased by living in a society where we treat each other nicely, where we have a social safety net, this kind of stuff. Fine, but if somebody tortures a dog, burns them alive on a fire or something, because of the pleasure that they receive from doing so, I can't see any way for an objectivist of this brand to say that what they're doing is wrong. It in no way upsets their own survival. It in no way makes them closer to death. In fact, the sort of hedonistic release that they get from it may indeed bolster their life and make it more worth living and possibly even go on for longer for that reason. So how does your worldview capture the intuitive immorality of something like animal abuse?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think it's an intuitive issue. I think it's just a matter of fact that it is profoundly immoral to torture an animal for no good reason. I'm not against eating animals. I am against unnecessarily putting any animal through pain.
Sure.
And the reason is for the same reason that I hold life as the standard of value for human beings. Life as the standard of value is broader than just for human beings. Life is the standard of value for a flower, let alone a dog. I think it's wrong to just kick a beautiful flower. I don't think it's immoral on the order that if you do that, you should be, or certainly it shouldn't be illegal to do that. But I don't think it's even immoral on the grounds that if you see somebody do that, you would hold them in contempt for the rest of your life. If I saw somebody torturing a dog, I would hold the person in contempt for the rest of my life. But let's stick with the flower, because I want to take this to an extreme.
Yep.
A flower is a beautiful thing. It's alive. Why, it would be absolutely nihilistic to kick a flower dead just for the hell of kicking a flower dead. It's like hatred of the good for being good. It's hatred of life for being alive. So
blaspheming the Holy Spirit.
Yeah. And so there's a real richness and depth to this idea that life is the standard of value, because it is broader than just human life as the standard of moral value. It means that living, that life is profoundly unique and important, because it is the thing to which values pertain. It's the only thing to which values pertain.
And that sounds very attractive, but for your ideas here, or your worldview to be objective, you'd need to say that to the nihilist, who says, I just don't care. I just want to pick that flower. I honestly, I just don't recognize what you're talking about. You have to tell them that they are wrong, and presumably in a way that you could describe to them. So a moment ago when we were talking about life and death being intrinsic to ethics, there's an important distinction to make. It can be the life and death of the person doing the action, or the life and the death of the thing that's being acted upon. So it seemed like a moment ago you were saying that my ability to live and die is a requirement for my ability to be moral in my interactions with other people. Yep. But a flower, though it can live and die, is not a moral agent.
Yep.
A flower is not the kind of thing that can have a moral course of action. Maybe that's because it doesn't have free will. Maybe also that's because it doesn't have emotions. Right? I'm saying both of these can be explained on our worldviews equally. But when you say that, you know, it's wrong for me to kick that flower, if I'm going to be a rational egoist, which means that for me personally, my life is what matters, my survival prospects, me alone, and even other human beings, their survival prospects only matter insofar.
May I just correct one thing there?
Because
I don't want you to go on with a mistake.
I want to make sure I'm getting you right.
So egoism does not hold that your life and your life alone matters to you. Mm-hmm. It means that your life is your primary concern. Mm-hmm. A human life consists of all sorts of relationships that are extremely important to you.
Yeah, but so they're important to you.
Yes.
So that their value, so again, is...
Yeah, but
is,
they are important.
They're important, but they're only important insofar as they serve me.
They're important to you. There's direct importance, and then there's all sorts of indirect importance. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, there are people in China right now or in India right now who I don't know and you don't know. We don't know anything about what they're doing.
Yep.
But if they come to my mind, as they just have, because I've brought them up, do I wish them well? Yes, because they might be the person who invents the next thing that's just awesome for human life, right?
So, well, I wish them well, even if they were not.
Okay, either way, but the point is the potential in human beings is a valuable thing in and of itself.
I'm less attracted to that than I am about the whole kicking flowers thing, because I like to think that somebody who I've never met in China is doing well, regardless of their contributions. Indeed, even if they take more than they give throughout their life, maybe through no fault of their own, maybe they're disabled, and so they rely on state benefits and don't have a very high-paying job, and so spend a lot of taxpayers' money for themselves and don't give very much in return, I'd still wish them well.
Oh, I certainly would, too.
And not just as a product of, well, if I do that on the whole, if I practically adopt this life philosophy, it will be better for me. Although maybe I am, I mean, I would say that I'm essentially doing that in an emotional level, because when I think of that person, it makes me upset, and that's why I care about them. So it's not a criticism, by the way, for me to say that this is, you know, all about me, because the emotivist has to say that too. But the problem is that if even other human beings only matter insofar as they benefit me, then I can kind of see how that might be the case. I mean, you say you care about that man in China because he might invent the next big medicine, but a dog is not going to do that.
Yeah, but
a flower is certainly not going to do that.
You're still, I think, and I've been unclear, so my apology. I'm not saying that human beings matter only insofar as they matter to you. Mm-hmm. For the same reason that a flower matters enough that to kick it over needlessly, I mean, it's one thing to clip a flower to put it in a vase for your dinner, you know, to have a bouquet on the table. But if you're just kicking it over nihilistically, you could say, well, the flower doesn't matter to me, so I kicked it over. Mm-hmm. But the problem with that is you're treating a living thing with contempt.
But what's the problem with doing that?
The problem with doing that is that life is the very thing that gives rise to the business of valuing and of conceptual terms that we use for beauty. I mean, beauty... anything like that. I'm not saying it matters to you in the same way or to the same degree as other things. I'm saying it's nihilistic. It's treating life as if it's of no value. And if I were to say, well, I don't care about other people because I don't know them at all. Now, there's no reason for me to have them in my mind. I can't keep 8 billion people in my mind and live my life. But if you bring it up, if you say, do you care about somebody on the other side of the world living a beautiful life as against a not beautiful life, my thing is, yeah, I want everybody to live a beautiful life. And it's not only because they will have some connection to me, although that potential is extremely important. It's because I have a reverence for life because life is the standard of value.
Yeah, it seems to me, if I may, that this is arguing in a circle, though, unfortunately, because when... Well, I'm asking you to justify your view that life has value, that life is the value-giving thing in the universe. If there can be such thing as a value, life is where it comes from. And I say, well, if that's the case, then what if the person who kicks the flower and doesn't care? And you say, well, the problem with that person is that they're not treating life as intrinsic value.
Yeah.
But that's the very thing that I'm trying to get you to establish.
Got it.
And so it can't be a response to my objection. I need to introduce you to the person who does not think that life is intrinsically valuable. I mean, I don't think life is intrinsically valuable.
So I don't think it's intrinsically valuable either. So we have there's something I need to clarify there.
And so kicking that flower, if you say that, well, the problem with that is that it treats living things with contempt. And I say, well, so what? I mean, the idea that you shouldn't treat things with living things with contempt is the very thing that I'm trying to get you to establish, if you see what I'm saying.
So life... to any human being, when only human beings choose the option of staying alive or not. So this can't apply to animals that don't have that kind of choice, and it certainly cannot apply to plants. So when we as human beings are thinking about the value of animals or plants to us, it's a very, very, it's substantially removed from the normal way that we're talking about values. I went to the flower because you brought up somebody kicking a dog, and I wanted to make the further extreme point that I think contempt for life generally. But life itself, so my life does not have intrinsic value. Why does my life have value? It is the way that I hold this, and this is essentially Ayn Rand's view as well. We either choose to remain in existence or not. That's a choice that as adults we all have. I think the youngest recorded suicide in history is something like a 6-year-old, but that's very rare, and normally it doesn't start until, you know, the possibility doesn't even come into existence until 10 or 12, and then that's pretty damn rare too. So when you're a child, you don't even have this idea that there's an option of exiting. But when we get to the point that we do understand that that is an option, you then, at least implicitly, are regularly making the choice to remain in existence, to remain alive. You could leave. You always have that option. Now, there are good reasons for most people to remain in existence. Life is full of wonder and full of potential and full of possibility. So people tend to make the choice to stay in existence far more often than not. But it is the very choice to remain alive that gives rise to the need of values. It's only the choice to live that makes valuing possible. So if I said, I don't want to live anymore, but then my next question was, you know, what should I go after? What should I value? You would look at me like I was crazy.
Well, if
you don't want to live, you don't need anything. So the point here is simply that in terms of logical dependence, the choice to remain alive precedes any evaluation.
I'm not 100% sure about this. I'm actually far less than 100% sure about this. For example, trivially, the person considering suicide who says, I don't want to live anymore, what should I do? If I'm just willing to grant that they've made a correct evaluative judgment there, it seems like you're saying I must say something like, well, that's a silly question. You can't ask what should I do if you don't want to stay alive. But of course, if they just sit there and sit around, they'll be there for at least 3-4 days, just sitting there doing nothing, and then they'll eventually die. But I could say, but if you go up to the top of this building and throw yourself off, you'll die a lot more quickly. You'll achieve your goal much more quickly. And so given your evaluative goal, that's what you should do. And so you've still got this system of values which imply certain things that you should or shouldn't do.
Well, you're assuming they want to die more quickly. I was just starting with the point they don't want to remain in existence. And you're just saying, well, there's a faster way to do it.
Yeah.
If you don't want to remain in existence, you can just sit down and in short order, 3 days or so, you'll be gone. Mm-hmm. Or you can do something to make it happen faster. So there's no substantive disagreement there. My point is that unless you want to live, there's no cause for action.
Yeah, so again, there are a few things to say here. One thing is to say that this choice of living and dying seems to me one that you can't impart objectivity into.
You can't impart what?
Objectivity into. I mean, would you claim that it's objectively the right decision to stay alive? Right?
If that's
the case, then.
Yeah. So I hold that it is both the choice to remain in existence, to remain living, is both in a technical sense, premoral and even pre-rational. And the reason that it's premoral is because you don't need values until you've made the choice.
Okay.
And the reason it's pre-rational is because reason only has use value.
Sure.
You don't need reason or reasons or knowledge or truth or anything unless you choose to live. So the choice to live is just fundamental in that sense.
If finding the basis of ethics is starting with our moral claims that we make, it's wrong to murder, and saying, well, why? Well, we shouldn't murder because we shouldn't treat life with malice. Well, why? Because we should, and you sort of keep asking why, and then you eventually get something like, because you should remain alive. That
no.
should is either going to be objective or it's not, and if it's not, then the entire edifice that you've built upon it
no, it's not
is going
that
to be subjective
you
as well.
Should remain alive. So if I take Frederick Douglass
or that
put
I
him
alive.
In a cage and treat him like a subhuman animal and then put him out in the fields and make him do my work and then put him back in a cage at night, so just Mach 1 slavery, what is wrong with this? Why is slavery wrong? Well, because he is a human being, and a human life consists precisely in acting on his judgment and pursuing his values.
Mm-hmm.
So it's wrong for me to do that to him because he's a human being.
Why does that matter to you?
Pardon?
Why does it matter to you?
It matters to me because when we're talking about moral principles, we're talking about principles, and principles are things that apply to all of the units in the classification we're talking about. We're talking about human beings, and human beings have a certain nature.
Uh-huh.
I, of course, want to live my life and have a beautiful life,
yep.
but I don't own her life or his life or your life. Your life belongs to you. So this is where just as the requirements of life give rise to the principles of morality, one of the principles of morality that gives rise to a proper political system is the moral principle of individual rights.
I don't see what the principle is here, because a moment ago I thought that we were talking about rational egoism, that for me, the thing that matters is my survival and flourishing.
Yeah.
And now it seems, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you're suggesting that somehow my recognition that, you know, I desire my own flourishing and life is somehow indicative that every person has this intrinsic value amongst them that I should respect, even if it wasn't of benefit to me.
So I don't think every person has intrinsic value. Every person has value insofar as he or she chooses to live and is respecting the rights of others to do the same. So if a jihadist mm-hmm. comes after Ayaan Hirsi Ali and tries to kill her, and I'm there and I shoot him dead, I did not destroy a value. This guy had no value at all. He had turned himself into a subhuman, sub-animal creature who had no value at all.
But
so
suppose he...
There's no. My point here is simply that human life is not intrinsically valuable. It's valuable if you choose to live and if you stick with the program of living as a human being as against living as a not human being.
I think we might be getting confused between what I said earlier about like the prospect of living and dying in the person committing the moral act and the person upon whom the act is being committed. So suppose a not suicide murderer, just a murderer, decides to kill somebody,
yeah.
and they say, well, I value my own life, I value my own flourishing, and maybe they... And suppose, you know, it were actually the case that given the intricacies of their life, it would be better for their life, it would be better for their flourishing if this innocent person were to be killed. And they go and do
yeah,
so.
I can't buy that because you can't sketch a realistic scenario in which that would be the case.
You can't think of a scenario in which the death of an innocent person would benefit you?
No.
Even hypothetically?
Not off the top of my head. Can you give me one?
So, for example, you're an unempathetic creature who genuinely just doesn't care for the well-being of others. And if that person...
You're going to a broken person.
Well,
you're
by what standard?
Okay, but... morality applies to the factual requirements of human beings given the kind of animals that we are under normal circumstances. If you tell me, well, what about a psychopath who doesn't care about anybody? How are you going to get him to accept your moral code? I'm not going to get him to accept my moral code. He can't understand why or wouldn't even care to understand
why. But is he acting unethically?
He's acting unethically from my perspective, even though he can't understand it.
But is he acting unethically, because from my standard sounds awfully subjective, is he acting immorally objectively?
He's acting objectively more immorally given the factual requirements of human life, which he apparently cannot understand because he is a broken human being.
But if it's a factual requirement of human life, then he can't be a human life without that thing. It can't be a factual requirement of human life, because here's a human life that doesn't have that.
So yeah, when we're talking about a class of anything, we're talking about the general characteristics of that class. Now, there are always outliers, and in the case of human beings, there are outliers, borderline cases, where, take Terry Schiavo, who in Florida, you know, 15, 20 years ago, was essentially brain dead, and she was in the hospital. You know the case.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the question was, some of her family wanted to pull the plug and let her die, and others were saying, no, we want to keep her alive because God or something. And she was clearly, her brain was just sauce. Mm-hmm. She was not a living being. So did Terry Schiavo have rights? Did she have a right to live at that point? Well, no, she wasn't even there anymore. There was no there. And in the case of the kind of person you're talking about, a psychopath who, if you let him out, is going to run around and try to kill people or something, this is a subhuman creature whom morality does not apply anymore because he's so broken that there's no there.
They're still alive? They're still rational creature. They're still Homo sapiens.
He's not a rational creature.
He's rational in, let's say, every other respect. Because again, I'm supposing, we're going to sort of bracket this moral thing because that's the thing we're investigating. I'm saying in every other respect, this person can do maths. This person can do.
Sure, he's got legs. He's got a thumb.
The only thing that's different about this person and you and me is that this person doesn't care about the suffering of others.
Yeah.
That's literally the only difference. I mean, imagine literally a twin Craig sat next to you who is. Yeah. Even in this conversation, like, everything is exactly the same.
Yeah.
Except don't care for other people. For that person, if somehow the death of an innocent person that they don't care about were going to turn them into a billionaire, and suppose that being a billionaire is actually going to be good for them, then because they don't, I mean, I would look at them going and murdering that person, and I would go, you know, boo. And certain forms of moral objectivists, you know, divine command theorists would say, it doesn't matter what you know, your flourishing, your life, all this kind of stuff, what matters is that this is wrong in principle. But for the person who just says that the only reason this could possibly be wrong is insofar as it's derived from some course of action that, like, diminishes my prospects for life and flourishing, it doesn't diminish this person's prospects for life.
No, but it killed an innocent person. So let me take, I'll take...
But then again, we're moving from the life and death requirement of the moral actor...
Yeah.
And
I'm going to stick with your guy. I'm not going to focus on the moral actor. On the victim. Beyond the point of just pointing out that the victim had a right to life because he was a human being who was respecting rights, presumably. Now, if the psychopath kills Hitler, I don't care. But if it's a rights respecting human being who has rights, let me finish the question. Uh-huh. If the psychopath goes and kills the guy, and your position is, well, if he's an egoist and he thought that was good for him. You know, what's the problem? Egoism is not that blinded by the full context of the situation of what it means to live a human life. An egoist doesn't say, anything that works for me, I'm going to do, come hell or high water, even if it includes violating other people's rights. And if somebody doesn't understand that and can't be convinced of it and is going to go commit violence, and we know that, or if he actually does commit violence, it doesn't matter what he thinks. It doesn't matter what he values. It doesn't matter what he's willing to do. We have a right based on the fact that our life is our proper ultimate end, and that we understand that life is the standard of value and that human beings have rights. We have a right to say, you are too broken to be free. You have to be in a home, and it's very unfortunate, but that's the way it is. Now, if you're unsatisfied with that answer, all I can say to you is, it's both moral and practical from my perspective, and I think it makes sense. And the alternative is only that we're going to have him run around and just say boo to him every time he kills somebody. I don't say boo when somebody kills somebody else. I say that's a violation of the fundamental principles of morality. First of all, you violated rights. And secondly, you violated every other principle, tying all the way down to the fact that human life is the standard of moral value. So, we'll just have to disagree on this point if my explanation of the fact that we who do recognize human life and individuals as having a right to their life as the standards here have the right to put that guy in a cage and say, you can't be free.
But that standard relies on the very thing that you're trying to justify, which is the existence of objectively moral properties of the universe, such as rights.
No.
The introduction of rights, for example.
Rights are not intrinsic. You're so you're assuming that rights are out there.
No, they're not. Because you were saying a moment ago that, you know, the sort of grounding of ethics is rational egoism. Mm-hmm. However, you know, the rational egoist isn't blind to things like the rights that another person has. Well, yeah. Why would the rational egoist care about the rights of another person? What are these rights? If ethics is just about me and my sort of rational prolonging of my prospects of survival,
because the rational part of the rational egoist means that he's going to use his mind. He's going to take into mm-hmm. account all of the relevant facts surrounding his life. And one of those relevant facts is that other people can be, and often are, and in many ways specifically to his life, are enormously valuable. He has mm-hmm. to buy groceries. Somebody's got to make those groceries. He's got friends. He's got people he goes dancing with. He has drinking buddies. He's got the whole nine yards. And so he realizes that other people, A, can be of value to him. He also realizes that they have minds and bodies and therefore have rights to live their own lives. And he respects rights because, being a rational person, he thinks in terms of principles, not in terms of what can I get away with. So I think the rational part of rational egoism has to be emphasized here.
None of that applies to this psychopath, right? And so
he's a psychopath. That's why we have that term.
But when you put this psychopath, and a psychopath is just a descriptive statement to describe a person with a certain kind of brain. That's all it is.
Yeah.
And if you put this person in jail, I would say that of course it's rational to do that because I care about my well-being. This person's going to really, really mess up my well-being and mm-hmm. that of people I care about. So I put him behind bars. But mm-hmm. I recognize that I put him behind bars because I don't want him to be free. Not because he is not abiding by an objective standard that would exist regardless of what my preferences are.
Oh, I'm not putting him behind because he's not abiding by objective standard either, because he can't. He's a psychopath. But if your definition here is that he's incapable of thinking in those terms, I'm not like, well, hey, you're doing the wrong thing. He can't be wrong. He's so broken that he's just dangerous without even being wrong.
So he's not doing something wrong then?
No, he's outside of morality. He's not even a moral creature. He's so broken that he has no capacity to be moral or immoral or anything else.
But he can still make decisions about whether he lives or dies. Because here's the next problem.
Yeah.
A moment ago we were told that what ethics is essentially the product of people making decisions about what's going to make them live or die. And as long as you're able to do that, that makes you an ethical creature. But now here's a further counterexample of the psychopath who can still make decisions that will either lead to prolonging his life or to his death. But now you're saying that this is not a moral creature. So, once again, another example of why I don't think that morality is intrinsically tied to life and death in the way that you were saying
earlier. When we talk about, when we use concepts, so if I use mm-hmm. the concept of man, that concept refers to not only a rational animal, which would be the definition of man, it refers to all of the characteristics of man, qua his normal circumstances as a being we call man. If I use the concept of dog, you would bring to mind an animal with four legs and a tail and this, that, and the other. And if I said, well, what about this dog over here? It only has three legs. How can you call him a dog? Mm-hmm. You would say, well, that's a special circumstance. He's a broken dog, and he's a dog in certain respects, but he's not a complete dog. I'm telling you now that this person is so incomplete in the sense that his capacity to understand the fact that other people own their lives and have a moral right to live, and his inability to explain, to understand and operate on that principle makes him too dangerous for us to have out running around.
For us.
And therefore, for us. Mm-hmm. And we have
a right
because he will kill people if we let him run around to put him in a cage and say, this is just too bad.
A right. I want to make sure I'm understanding you when you say we have a right.
Yes.
What kind of
Okay.
Standard, are you getting this right?
So let me define right for you.
Also, I want to make sure we're conscious of time, because I want to make sure we've got time for Q&A, but I also want to make sure we exhaust
what we need to exhaust. So we started at 4:15. We should start the Q&A now. Let me define right, so you understand what...
I'll let you have the last word here, and then we'll open it up.
And you can reply to this if you want before we start, but just so you understand, because I'm not using a term just sort of out of sure. I don't want this to be out of the blue.
Sure.
I regard a right as a moral principle that is this. It is the all moral principles are recognitions, that's the in here part, of a fact, something out there. And so in this case, what is it that we're recognizing when we talk about a right? We are recognizing a fact, and that fact is this. In order for a human being to live fully as a human being, he must be free to act on the very thing that makes him a human being, the judgment of his mind. Okay? In order for a human being to live fully as a human being, he must be free to act on the very thing that makes him a human being, the judgment of his mind. The psychopath is so broken that he will violate the fact that everyone else has this right if we let him act on the judgment of his mind, because his mind is so broken. So we have the right to say, let me finish.
Yeah.
We have the right to say, by nature of your problem, you cannot have the right to be free, because you will destroy the rights of other people. And that is a perfectly legitimate way to conceptualize the situation of this kind of person. We do the same thing with criminals, even though they many times can understand these ideas. But if they have violated rights, we say, you forfeited your rights. In their case, it's because they could understand it, but they didn't. We put them in jail. Sometimes they get put to death. We could talk about whether that's justified or not. But certainly putting them in jail for life if they murder people is. So a right is simply the recognition of this fact, that human beings need freedom from force in order to live. And we enforce that. Why? Because the whole purpose of moral principles, and in my view of proper political principles, is to enable human beings to live as independent agents without being coerced or killed or raped or whatever by other people. So that's the rights are really, really tied to egoism in the sense that their purpose is to enable individuals to pursue their values and flourish. Mm-hmm. And if somebody violates rights, you can't do that thing. So that's why we get to lock him up, regardless of what he understands.
I'm mostly interested in moving to Q&A. I would only say, I suppose I'd ask the audience to imagine, I don't know, sort of the sort of arbitrariness of saying that a person with a certain brain is broken and a person with a certain other kind of brain is not, if it's not just going to be based on majority, if it's going to be based on some principle about what a brain ought to be that is completely unrelated to how many people have different kinds of brains, then I want you to imagine everybody dying except for a single psychopath and a single non-psychopath, and the first person saying that their brain is broken and the other person saying, no, my brain's just fine, it's yours that's broken, and see if you can find any kind of standard that would allow you to say that one of those people was correct according to anything other than what they thought a brain should do subjectively. That's the only question that I would leave in the mind of the people listening.
All right, let's start some questions.
But let's have some more.
Oh, before we get started, a couple things. A lot of people behind you, so A, please do make it a question and keep them to 30 seconds, if you would.
I'll talk very quickly.
Thank
you so much. I'm from New York, I can do that. Okay, so I hate that you left it with a question, because that really makes you want to talk more, but I'm not...
You need to slow down a little bit or we're not going to be able to catch your words.
Okay. I hate that you started with a question, because it only makes me want to talk more. So I want to preface this with, I am very fond of both of you, and I agree with you on almost everything. And I came into this agreeing with you, but I haven't vacillated in my opinion. I only have more to say, but I'll be quick. I don't think I'm looking at two people that fundamentally disagree with each other. I think that there is an arbitrary nature in the ought, right? Like the is in the ought part. And I think that that is dependent on the individual. Right? But do you think that we can ground, like, do you think emotivism is a part of objectivism, or that emotivism can lead to objectivism when you take the majority of, like, what most people feel, their whatever emotions they derive from an action, and then it's basically like a democracy. Whatever most people want, whatever most people say yum to or yay to, would be what's objectively good. And I don't think it's just a coincidence that most of us say yum to not murdering each other.
Need to wrap this up with a question, please,
Anna. Sorry. Do you think that emotivism can lead to objectivism, or that emotivism can be a derivative of objectivism, that they can coexist within a moral or philosophical framework?
Do you want to answer that?
Whoever wants to answer.
Please.
I'm happy to. No, I don't think so. Now, objectivism is 100% pro-emotion. So let me just put that on the table, and I said this in my talk yesterday. We're all about emotions. We just recognize that emotions are your psychological means of experiencing your values, and that's their role in human life. They're not our means of knowledge, and they're certainly not our means of telling us what is good and bad, right and wrong. Our means of understanding what's good and bad, right and wrong is our rational faculty, through which we say, why do we even need such terms? And then if we continue asking that question, we get down to the fact that life is the standard of value. So emotivism is the idea that the only thing that we have to say about things that we regard as immoral or as moral is boo or rah. And I certainly do not hold that that is the case, and objectivism does not hold that at all.
I agree that it's not objective. We didn't really talk about emotivism much, which I'm kind of glad of. It's difficult to be the one doing the defending, I suppose.
Well, is it not the case? There's not a lot to say about it.
Well, there are some things. And one thing I was going to say in response to what you just said was that I think that an emotivist framework can probably make sense of more moral phenomena than I think something like objectivism. So, for example, we were talking about the dog and the plant, and you could say that ethics is broadly grounded in rational egoism, and there's some sense in which I've developed maybe a principle of like care about life or value of life, which somehow derives from my value of my own life, and that applies to the dog in a sense that makes killing the dog wrong. That doesn't seem very clear to me in a way that, like, if ethics is just emotive, then the fact that there are animals that look more like us and look less like us, and we think that some are more moral to kill and less moral to kill, it seems to make sense of that. Another slightly uncomfortable example of emotivism, but I think, unfortunately, the best one is the incest taboo that exists in almost every single society we've ever discovered. People think it's immoral, and it's quite entertaining watching rational moralists do one of two things. Either try to jump through hoops to find some way of saying that there's some rational principle that, intrinsically, I mean, it's causing some kind of suffering. You know, people talk about children, but it doesn't have to involve the production of children. Or they sort of be the hyper-rationalist and say, well, actually, controversially, I can't see anything wrong with it. Yeah. Either of those, you know, you can do that if you like, but it's still true that the vast majority of people in the world don't like it and think it is wrong and immoral. And yet, if you identify the kind of feeling that is probably motivating that, I would say it is just that, a feeling. It is essentially people going, yuck, no.
Yeah, and I
think emotivism makes
sense. And that may be,
that.
Yeah, it may be that in certain cases when there is no principle and people just do jolly well, de facto they do have just yuck, and that's all they have to say about it. I think that's true. It's an interesting thing. I think if you don't have an objective standard of moral value that you understand, and you understand why it's objective, I can totally understand why somebody would think that, yeah, this stuff is just a matter of preference. So this is one of the things I love about these conversations. It helps people to think about, well, is it true that there is no objective standard, mm-hmm. in which case maybe emotivism is correct, or is it true that there is an objective standard, in which case I might have used to been an emotivist, but now I see that this makes more sense. Look, we're all learning all the time, and you can only work with the concepts that you have. You know, I don't like shake my finger at people. How come you're not a rational egoist? They're like, I don't even know what it is. You know, how could I know? How could I be held to be responsible for that if I don't know what the thing is? So,
Thanks a lot. Thank you, Em. Thank you.
This is a question for Craig. Could you just elaborate on something you said? You said that the question to live or not to live, or if you want to commit suicide, is a pre-rational question, as a pre-rational thing. Could you just elaborate on that real quick?
Yeah, it's pre-rational it's a technical sense in which it's pre-rational, right? And the best way to see that it is for me to say, if I were to say to you, I don't want to live, and I was earnest about that, I was done, and maybe I had good reason, maybe I was in such pain and had cancer and was going to die soon anyway, I was like, I'm done, I'm exiting. Maybe I'm in a concentration camp or whatever. For some reason, I had good reason to say I want to exit. And then you were to say, but let me give you reasons not to. Now, if I have already decided to exit, a reason is a value, right? It's something that you need if you want to live. So the very idea of saying, well, you know, you need to do this or you need to listen to that if the person has actually made the decision. Now, if you think it's a, if it's a friend and you think you can convince him or her that it is worth living, then reasons can still apply. But that's because the decision has not been finite. But if it's really finite, it's technical in this sense. You only need values, including things like reason or knowledge or truth or any of those things. They're all values of sorts. You only need those if you choose to live. So it's just pre-rational in that choice. No one as an adult makes the choice to live or not to live by ignoring everything about his life. It would be impossible, right? When people choose to kill themselves, if they do, or when people choose to live and go after their values, if they do, they do it for reasons that they've thought through. And so in that sense, you are thinking about it. You're using reason to make the decision. So it's only in that technical sense of you don't need values if you don't want to live.
Good evening.
Hi.
So my question is for Alex. Alex, is it not the case that by engaging in this debate, you performatively presume the value of rationality, that people ought to be rational, that the very act of engaging in a rational dialogue advocating for emotivism is to present what you believe to be reasons for why people ought to embrace emotivism? If we reject the notion that there can be any truth value to moral claims, does this not reduce your very case for emotivism to be nothing but yay emotivism?
Yes, I would say it probably does. But that's just what I think ethics is. And so to the extent that there are value judgments at the foundation of epistemology, as an emotivist, I would have to say that those are emotivist expressions. They're emotive expressions. And so the extent to which I say, you know, me coming here incurs or requires some kind of value, well, sure, I value a great deal of things. I value having interesting conversations. I value, answering questions from people in an audience. I think it's fun. I think it's enjoyable. I think it's edifying. Can I say that I should do those things, therefore? Yes, as long as I translate that should in an emotivist framework, which just means, like, yay. It's an emotive feeling. I mean, it doesn't mean yay, but it means something analogous to yay. And so, yeah, I wouldn't say you should be an emotivist in the sense that there's some kind of objective moral standard by which you're not to which you're not according if you're not an emotivist. I would just say that, like, to the extent to which you're able to sort of engage with what I'm saying and understanding the arguments I make, you then hearing that and going, I'm not an emotivist, just makes me sort of go, you know, boo, man.
If odd is a mere expression of emotion, then does that not undermine any binding force that your arguments could have?
Oh, yeah, yeah, no, it does. Oh, no, my arguments...
Could you repeat the question? I didn't hear that.
If odd is a mere expression of emotion, then does that not undermine any binding force that your arguments could have?
Any binding force that my argument can have? Ethically, yes, but rationally, no. So
that presumes the value of rationality.
There are two ways that something combined. Rationality combined, I think, amorally, and that's a controversial position. I don't mean controversial as in it's unpopular. I mean that people debate it. I think that rationality can just lead you into the arms of a conclusion. If I show you that there are two glasses here and two bottles here, rationality dictates that there are four drinks receptacles on the table. Is that a moral statement? I just don't think so. I really don't. And so the point that I make, I mean, if I make a point like that, if I say, look, there are two here and there are two here, if somebody uses the language, therefore you should believe there are four, I think they're slightly misusing the word should. Maybe, you know, they might mean something like rationality, your rational faculties are going wrong. Again, not in a moral sense, but in the way that like a chair that doesn't hold things up is a bad chair. Use the word bad, but you wouldn't say it's an immoral chair. You know what I mean? I feel like it's something like that going on with rational statements. But to the extent to which I make any kind of ethical claim, and maybe you think that is an ethical claim, in which case, yes, it would undermine any binding force outside of, given that I think that, like Craig said a moment ago, I don't go around saying, you know, why aren't you a rational egoist? I sort of go around saying that you are an emotivist. I think that is what people are doing. And so I think, well, not an emotivist, because that requires believing you're doing that, but I think you are just emoting. And so if I were to sort of raise the same kind of moral feeling within you, or say, let's say that sort of it failed to raise within you, then the extent to which I'm using the language of like, oh, you should do this, or you should think this moral statement, I'm sort of booing the fact that you don't also feel boo, if you see what I'm saying. It's quite hard to get the language right here, but I hope that makes sense.
So my question is for both of y'all, and it's about the idea of life being the objective standard of value, or moral value. And see, there can be equivocation of what you mean by life. And I think Alex is pointing this out when he gave that thought experiment of the immortality. He's basically, that thought experiment shows that physical survival is not the standard moral value because Craig, you said ethics would still exist even in that scenario, even though your physical survival is guaranteed. So
What is the question?
Yeah, the question is, so Ayn Rand talks about spiritual survival, psychological survival, and my question is, what do you think of that being the objective standard of value, that standard, that survival, that would even apply to psychopaths, because they would have their own type of consciousness, their own type of ego, that they would have to be, they have to act a certain way to promote that type of survival, even if it's a different type
what
of
ego. What is your question?
What's your thoughts on that standard value?
Yeah. So Rand holds, and I agree with her, that human life, the idea that human life is the standard of value does not mean mere survival. It means survival qua man, as she put it, which means given the full capacities of man. It means essentially flourishing. And she even said that life and happiness are, in effect, two sides of the same coin. Right, they're two perspectives on the same achievement. You achieve happiness by pursuing your life-serving values and succeeding in those pursuits, and then you have this thing called happiness. But the reason that life is the standard of value and happiness is not is because happiness is simply a state of consciousness, where life is a state of biological existence plus consciousness, so it captures both of them. And you can see this by the fact that you can be alive but not be happy, but you can't not be alive, but you can't be happy if you're not alive, right? So one of them is more fundamental than the other. So she does not mean, and she would say you would be freezing the abstraction of life if you just meant your heart is still beating. She means life in the full capacity of a human being, which is why virtues and values are necessary and freedom is necessary so that you can live that way. Again, if you put somebody like Frederick Douglass in a cage and treat him like an animal, he can't live as a human being. That's why slavery is wrong. So that's the essential answer to that. Thanks.
I would just like to add that I think implausibly suggests to me that a long unhappy life is more valuable than a short happy one.
A long unhappy life is more valuable? I don't think that I would have to think about that kind of calculation, but I think there's no reason to make those kinds of calculations, because what you have as any individual is you have whatever your capacities are. Maybe you have cancer and you're going to die, and you know that in a few years, then you want to live in a certain way during that time. If you don't, then your expectation is, hey, I want to live as long as I can and as healthfully as I can and as happily as I can. And there's no reason for anybody to play with the thought experiment, would you rather live a short life that's really happy or a long life that's not happy? There's no need for that hypothesis.
You might not need to make that choice, but it would still be true of two lives that in fact exist, one of which is very, very happy and 25 years long, and one which is quite unhappy, maybe still majority happy, but still quite unhappy and lives for, say, 35 years old.
Perhaps, but the comparison is unnecessary, because if you just talk about two people, you'd say, well, this guy died a few years ago and only lived for 30 years and he was really happy, and this guy lived to 80 and he was medium happy. Which one of these guys had a better life? I don't know. You'd have to ask them and bring that guy back and make the comparison. Nothing hangs on this question. It doesn't make any difference, because individuals have only the control of their own lives, and they can take the actions to make their lives the best they can be, which in my view is what we all should do. And if they don't do that, it's a tragedy. And if you have a short life, that's tragic. And if you have a long life and it's not happy, I think that's tragic.
It's an important meta-ethical question. I mean, I think there's no import in comparing two different kinds of lives, but if there are just, in fact, two lives that we know, because they've been lived and there have been thorough self-report studies into these two lives, one of them is happier and 25 years old when they die, and one of them is less happy and 30 years old when they die, I would say that I'd rather have the 25-year-old's life, even though there's less life.
That's fine, and that could be your preference. I have no position on it, because my position is always that each individual should simply do the best he can to live a beautiful life for himself. Sure. And so I get no value out of that comparison. I just wouldn't take a position on it.
Thanks. Thank you.
My question.
We're out.
Questions for Alex.
I think we have a dead mic.
My question for Alex, and I promise I actually came up with it a couple weeks ago. I wasn't expecting Craig and three others to spend an hour on stage yesterday talking about it, and it sounded like it's what you're about to get into before we jump to Q&A. My question is, can you justify the existence of universal human rights from a materialist and emotivist point of view?
No, I don't think so. That's why I don't believe in them.
Thank you.
Oh, so, sorry, I don't mean to be blunt, but really, I just don't believe that there are such things. I believe that rights are something a bit like the so-called metaphorical truths, things which we don't actually believe are true. Of course, there aren't these real things called rights that exist somewhere in the universe, but acting as if there are makes life better. So another good example is the gun is always loaded. It's not, obviously, but let's act as though it is, and we'll probably be in a better scenario. But I don't think they actually exist, and I don't think the gun is actually, in fact, always loaded, if you see what I'm saying. But I agree, yeah, I think people who try to do that are, as Bentham had it, producing nonsense upon stilts.
I agree. Thank you very much.
Hi. Question for Alex.
Hi.
What evidence would you like to see to be convinced that objective morality does exist?
I would like to be shown, firstly, I'd need to know what somebody means by like morality. So terms like good and bad, I'd need them to be defined. I understand that some things are difficult to define, but we'd need to at least a sort of family resemblance model of what we mean by good. So, for example, a theist might say that good means to approximate the nature of God, and then the evidence would become proof of God's existence. Maybe a Neoplatonist might say that good is to approximate the form of good, and then I would need a philosophical proof of the existence of the philosophical forms. So it depends on the kind of objective ethics that they're proving or trying to establish. I suppose my problem with something like rational egoism is not so much that, you know, I understand and accept the terms, but don't think the thing that it's attaching itself to exists. I just think that the thing it's attaching itself to, which would be something like human life, or maybe in some circumstances it seems human flourishing, is not a good definition of what morality is, and it doesn't capture what people are really talking about when they say good and bad. For reasons including valuing people even if they're not, even if we know for a fact they're not going to contribute to us, I still wish them well. Facts like that. Facts like not wanting to kill a dog, but being kind of all right with killing a flower, this kind of stuff. I think that it doesn't capture what people mean when they say the words good and bad. So in this instance, the proof I would be looking for is why something like life and its prolongment is a good definitional capture of what people mean by ethics. But broadly speaking, I'd be looking for a definition that captures what people mean by ethics and then proof that that thing exists. But it will depend on the theory.
And if I may, just real quick, because I want to, it's a perfect opportunity to get the definition of these things from the objectivist perspective on the table. You might not agree with them, but they're there. They're important. So the good, according to objectivism, is a species of the true. The good is that which promotes human life, given the kind of animal we are. So there's a truth. There are things that do promote our lives, and there are things that do harm or destroy our lives. So it's a fact. A value is a species of fact. It's a kind of fact. Values are the things that we go after in life that, in fact, will support our life. So that's how Rand defines value and good. And it's, of course, by reference to life as the standard of value in both of those cases. And then she simply defines ethics or morality as a code of values to guide your choices and actions, the choices and actions that determine the purpose and course of your life. So those are the definitions that come out of her grounding ethics in life.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks. That was great. My question is for Craig. So earlier on in the debate, you said that it was implicitly or just, it was wrong to torture animals or dogs, but that eating them and killing them isn't necessarily wrong. And this seemed to me...
What isn't necessarily wrong?
Eating and killing animals.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And this seemed to be a bit contradictory to your overall theory, which seems to prioritize life and then only suffering if you can link it to life. And I'm assuming your response to this would be something along the lines of there's some utility to eating animals, but there really isn't in torturing animals. But what if we did have, I guess, a population where there is more utility in torturing animals? I'm wondering if your position would change and if you would say something along the lines of that's not realistic, those would be psychopaths. I would just like to add quickly that around 2 to 10% of the population are psychopaths, so I think washing your hands of this population, and people can also torture animals and not be psychopaths.
I need you to restate your question.
Yeah, sorry,
precisely,
a few caveats.
Otherwise, I won't be able to answer.
Yeah, how would you deal with that contradiction between saying torturing animals is wrong, but killing and eating them is okay when your moral theory seems to prioritize life okay. over suffering.
So there's a difference between animals and people in that animals are not conceptual. They don't have a rational faculty. They don't form concepts. They can't respect rights, let alone think about them. So, you know, if a tiger's charging you, you say, "Hey, wait! You know, I'm a human being. I live. I have my own life, and you have your own. You know, you're going to be dead before you finish your sentence, right? Because they're not in that category of things that can think this way. They don't live by using their rational faculty. They live by using instincts, and their instincts are devastatingly dangerous to us. If we, you know, don't use our minds to understand, you know, what the differences are between animals. Now, that said, life, as long as it is not threatening you, is life. And if you disvalue it in such a nihilistic way as kicking a dog or kicking a flower or something like that, again, I'm not going to hold you in contempt for the rest of your life. I see you kicking a flower, but I would be like, that's a really sort of disturbed person, or maybe she's really angry right
Isn't
now.
Isn't that a bit of a value judgment, that's nihilistic versus killing and eating animals?
Yeah, you can make value judgments that are not moral value judgments, right? Flowers have values even though they don't make moral value judgments. They have values because they go after things that support their lives. So you have to differentiate between values for things generally and moral values, which only come in the sphere of human choice. Human values are chosen, and we don't have automatic values. We have to decide what we're going to go after, and that's why we need to think about it and use our reason to understand which values are good for our life and which are not. That's what morality is. It's the science that works on that project. So animals just simply don't have rights in the same way that human beings do. They don't have moral rights to act on their judgments so that they can live as human beings. The concept of rights simply pertains to human beings, and in the history of its development, it only pertained to human beings. It's just, that's what the concept means. I am wide open to the possibility of another concept, and I've talked about this in the past, whereby we say there are certain kinds of things that deserve an interim level of respect. And I think dogs and certain kinds of animals should fall into that category. I'd love for some good philosopher to do some work on this, because I think torturing animals, putting animals in needless pain, is absolutely abhorrent. But you cannot give the concept of rights to them because they simply...
Killing them is okay? Like, what about pigs, which are
intelligent? Can't apply to an animal that's not conceptual.
Mm-hmm. But, like, okay. It seems like you think suffering is worse than killing them.
That was actually going to be my next objection, which is that it seems to me that saying something like, "I don't mind killing and eating animals, and at least most circumstances of eating animals, that is unnecessary. I don't mind killing and eating them as long as we're not torturing them," seems to value the torturing over the life.
Yeah, so here's the difference there. An animal, when it is killed, when it is properly killed, meaning killed as quickly as possible without pain, which is the way that all people who slaughter animals for food should be slaughtering them. They should be killed without pain, and that can be done. If you're not doing that, that's wrong. And when you do that, here's the thing about animals. They don't have a future in mind. They're not projecting a future. They can't do that because they're not conceptual. So they're just in a different category than we are. And I know a lot of people don't like that fact, but I think it's almost self-evident that they're not in the same category that we are. So we just have to, you know, and if you don't like my answer there, we would just have to agree to disagree on that. But that's the way I see it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I had the same exact question, but I will just ask follow-up. So how is the difference when you say it's okay, it's not okay when individual just for their joy just hit a flower? Is not morally objectively correct, but in that point, when we are society, when we don't need on large scale nutrition side need to kill animals, then we will decide to not allow this thing.
I am not understanding your question.
I think if I may,
so what's the difference when you say it's incorrect when individual is hitting flower and it's no need to do that? So when it's not needed to kill animals to get a nutrition we need, just because of the joy to kill animals, is it okay? So what's the difference?
Is the question, if we didn't need meat in order to live more healthfully and more happily, would I be against it?
Just assume it's just taste.
Okay. Yeah. I would, personally, if I could eat meat that was factory produced and had all of the nutrients that meat that I like to eat have, I would much prefer to eat that and not have animals killed.
When you say like to eat, do you mean in terms of taste or in terms of the nutritional benefit?
Pardon?
When you say like to eat, all the meat that I would like to eat, do you mean in terms of taste or nutritional benefit?
I would package both of those together because, again, I don't think animals have rights. So it doesn't bother me greatly that we put animals to death to use them for food unless it is done with pain that is unnecessary, which I think is just on its face wrong. But I do want to live my life with the kind of joy and health that I get out of eating the meat that I eat now. And because I've never heard an argument for why or how animals could have rights, and I fully understand the argument for why and how human beings have rights, I simply make a sharp divide there.
I think, what's your name?
Sandro.
Sandro. Nice to meet you, Sandro. I think Sandro asked a question which proves you've been listening very closely, and I think this was a wonderful question. That earlier you said that to step on a flower just because you sort of enjoy it would
be wrong.
Yeah,
there's a difference between immoral and...
Hold on, but to kill an animal because you enjoy it, and I know that you're packaging in nutritional value, but let's say that we were able to get nutritional value, but it all tasted horrible, then you're talking about something like taste pleasure. Yeah. Stepping on a flower because you enjoy it is horrible, nihilistic, but killing an animal because you enjoy it, because you enjoy the way it tastes, is not?
Yeah, there's a difference. So when you kick a flower for no reason, just life, dead, you're expressing a contempt for life. When you raise an animal, as most, as the good cattle farmers do, treating them well, feeding them, if you've watched that show, Yellowstone, and you watch how actual Montana cattle farmers love these animals, but when they put them to death, they put them to death quickly and as painlessly as possible. That is using the animal for good purposes, nutrition and joy. That is very different from kicking a flower for no good reason just because life, beauty, kill. That, to me, is a nihilistic motive, and that's why I differentiate it, and there is nothing nihilistic about eating meat. So that's I regard that as a clear and distinct difference.
Okay, thank you.
We have 2 minutes, so we'll take a couple more questions. Thank you.
Great, thank you both. It's been a very thought-provoking panel. Craig, I would love to know your point of view. So life has value, right? 100% clear. What will happen if someone who doesn't value their lives and wants to kill themselves gets murdered by somebody else? And I don't mean like assisted suicide.
So a person wants to kill himself?
Yes, and gets murdered by somebody else.
Oh, and then they get murdered by someone else?
Yes.
Okay.
So it wasn't like a consensual thing. Will you think that's immoral?
So when you say they get murdered by somebody else, do you mean that they got assisted suicide?
No, like a gun or something.
Okay, so let's say I want to die, and I'm thinking about killing myself later today, but Alex pulls out a gun and shoots me dead. Okay.
Great question. Is that immoral?
And does he...
That's a great question.
So just to make it graphic here on stage... Oops.
What happened to my...
thing fell off my ear there. Yes, that is still murder, because no one has a right to take anyone's life except the person himself. And it doesn't matter what those circumstances are. Now, what can happen morally is someone can contract with another person and say, look, I want to die, but I don't like the gruesome business of doing it myself. Would you assist me in this? I'm for the right to assisted suicide. But murder is murder, and you do not have the right to take anyone else's life. So if someone did that, I think they should be tried, and if they're tried and found guilty, they should be locked up for life.
Including the psychopath?
Including what?
The psychopath.
If it was the psychopath who did the killing, or the psychopath?
Either way around.
Who was killed. It would be absolutely wrong to kill the psychopath, because although he is broken, now, if it's a psychopath who has murdered someone... Then he doesn't really even have a right to life, but he wouldn't be out killing people anyway. Presumably he'd be in jail. Even a psychopath who we can't let out because he will kill people, and we know that. But he has minimal rights. He has a right to remain in existence as long as we can keep the confines on him so that he can't act in a way that destroys other life. And if you got into the, you know, jail or wherever he's being held, hopefully it would be something more humane than a jail for this person. But if you got in there and killed him, yes, you would be a murderer and that would be wrong. You took a life that you don't have a right to take.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I think we have time. We're near
last question.
So, Alex, I'd like to ask you about the question you posed to all of us. And my question is very simple. In this scenario, we have these two people left, and we compare this sort of like character out of The Stranger who kicks over flowers and tortures dogs and kills people to, you know, the flourishing man whose life is full of entelechy. He, you know, he cups the flower, he pets the dog and befriends it, he saves people's lives. Is it not evident to you that there is such a non-arbitrary important difference between these two people? Like, is the brokenness in one not evident to you?
It's obvious to me, but of course, for me to imagine analyzing those people would be to place myself in that situation where I live too, and then there would be a majority of people who agree with me. If I was that person in that scenario, then of course it would be obvious to me. But those two people on that island, it's obvious, it's equally obvious to both of them. And the way that it's obvious to you and me now that, like, you know, killing a dog is totally wrong. And the way that that is just obvious to us, to the psychopath, it's just obviously who cares? That dog is just a dog. Like, it doesn't affect me in any way. That's just as obvious to them. So yes, it is obvious and intuitive to me. But my point is that the obviousness and intuitiveness of something like a moral feeling to me is not sufficient for me to say that that's some kind of objective truth. If that makes sense.
No time for a follow-up.
Thank you all.
Thank you. I'm so sorry. We had one more questioner. I'm so sorry we didn't have the time. Unless it's quick, and we do. I don't know if we literally need to run, but I felt so bad.
Oh,
we
go
had one
for
person,
it. I'm good,
you know?
For it. Yeah, yeah.
Well, one sentence, so we'll be short. Would you say that it can ever be moral to kill someone who does not want to die, including non-human animals?
Including non-human animals especially, I would say yes. There are certainly examples I can think of where, and again, because for me, morality is just a motive, there are certain situations where if I needed to, say, kill a cow that, I mean, trivially, if I needed to kill a cow that doesn't want to die in order to save the lives of everyone in this room, and indeed save them from some kind of torture or suffering, I would do so and probably wouldn't hesitate in doing so.
And you would call that moral?
I would call that moral insofar as I'm an emotivist. I would say that not doing that would make me go boo more than doing it, if you know what I mean. I don't mean to be sort of trivial or flippant, but it's unfortunate that Aya chose the words yay and boo. It's a little bit annoying, but I would use the words right and wrong, but I would translate them as emotions. So I would say it's the right thing to do there, but when I say right, I know that I'm just expressing how I feel about that situation. And I think most people in this room would probably agree, some may not, that the right thing to do there would be to kill that cow and save everyone in this room from torture or suffering. They might separate out the idea that that's morally right, but they'd certainly probably agree with my assessment of feelings that it would feel like bad if we didn't do that, you know?
Setting that particular example aside, I would just like to add one thing here about feelings. So on the theory that I hold, when you regard something as good or as bad, emotions come with that feeling. Like, we're very emotional. I'm very emotional about what I think is good and bad, right and wrong. So the emotions aren't, this isn't devoid of emotions. It's just that emotions are not the thing we're expressing. They're there, but the expression is it's anti-life or it's pro-life, and that's why we're saying good or bad. So.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Thanks, everyone. Cheers.